Welcome to a special edition of the Computer Weekly Downtime Upload podcast. I'm Cliff Saron, and today I am speaking to Sean Edwards, who has been CTO at Bloomberg since 2008. Sean, I think when we last spoke, that was in 2018 in Bloomberg's London office, you mentioned that you began your journey into tech when you were a child, reading Cosmos by the astronomer Carl Sagan. I'd love to hear that story again. I mean, just for the sake of our audience, and what was it all about?
Cliff, thanks for having me again. You know, I was really I was a young child, and my aunt had given me that book by Carl Sagan that led me into real interest in astronomy and had telescopes and just started reading more about science. And so I think it was just one of those kind of pivotal moments where someone, offers an insight into a new world. And that happened to be a family member, and my parents encouraged it. I'm the only technologist in the family. All the rest of my siblings are, teachers and principals and police officers. I'm the nerd of the family. And so I pursued that into a career, and thinking that I was going to go into physics, it turned out that, I met somebody, a friend of the family who was in electrical engineering. And I was like, wow, that's really cool. Not knowing much about it. And I fell in love with it. And my first job out of school, I got my undergraduate degree in electrical engineering. And after that, I went to work designing logic chips at IBM in Poughkeepsie, New York, working on their mainframes. And then they paid for my master's degree, and I was working, and I actually made a switch over to software after I met a professor who really taught software in this way that I could understand it, like really hardcore engineering and testing and layered design. And then since then, I haven't looked back.
But you've been in Bloomberg for a long time, and the tech sector has changed a lot. But just looking at how the industry has changed since you started at Bloomberg, what would you say has been broadly the biggest changes in the industry? And then perhaps we can talk a little bit about how Bloomberg has sort of taken that on board.
Yeah, I think that's, really interesting questions. I think about my 19 years, going on 20 years at Bloomberg. I think I've seen a lot of trends, and, I like to joke and say that our industry has more, its tech industry has more trends than the fashion industry, more fads. But there are some enduring things that I think have changed, and the one that has probably the most profound impact has really been the emergence of web-scale, high-performance, open-source software. When I started years ago, 19 years ago, Bloomberg really did not have an open-source policy. We had to build almost everything ourselves. But at the time, there was the beginning of some really high-quality open-source software, and that made sense in so many dimensions for us. And so I led the effort, I had to convince a lot of people, but led the effort towards really being an open source first company. Instead of automatically thinking, I have to rebuild this, let's look out there and see if there's something close enough, something that we can leverage the thousands and thousands of people out there who are contributing to these really great ecosystems of products. Mm. It makes sense financially, economically, but really about time to market and everything else. But with that, we came, I had to create an open source office, because you have to do that very carefully.
Yes.
You just can't pull on anything. Everything. There's some things that we shouldn't use, and we have to be really judicious about what to do, what to use.
Sean, but that to stop you mid-flow, how do you identify things that we should stare away from these open source components?
Yeah, I think it really comes down to what you're trying to achieve. It's not, there clearly are, I don't want to get into licensing discussion. So there are some branches, families of licensing, which would be, problematic for certain use cases. But aside from that, more what I'm talking about is that you're looking at a particular problem. Is this open source project, is this technology something that will be too intrusive? Will it force you to rewrite everything and kind of live in its ecosystem, or is it nicely, does it have nice APIs, going to be used in conjunction with other systems that you've already built? So a lot of that discussion is really about, what you're trying to do. And you also have to look at whether or not it has a really active development. Is there a group of people who are actively developing? You don't want a dead end product. You don't want a dead end open source software. Is things shifting away from it? Is there a vibrant community that is working well and not mirrored in politics and other things? So there's a number of things that we look at, but I think core of what I was mentioning, what I think about is whether it really fits in with what we're trying to achieve. Now, part of that, which I was going to say, is that, it's not just about using software, open source software. It's about contributing back. And we do that for a number of reasons, but we started by realizing that a lot of the projects weren't really fit for purpose for us. We often have these unique performance constraints, typically around latency. And a lot of the things that we were looking around did not have that latency focus. They were more, very large batch type of processing. And we have these kind of, we do have those needs. We have very large amounts of data, but we also, often in a lot of our systems, we have this really extreme latency requirement. So we've contributed back. And then once we did that, we coupled that with our desire to give back and our philanthropic bent to Bloomberg. And that's a way engineers can really give back to the world and make the world a better place. And so that is something that our engineering staff absolutely embraces and loves. And quite frankly, it's a great way to recruit talent.
Okay. I mean, I'm just going to throw it out there, but are there some of the, looking at what you've been talking about, and the first question I have for you as a follow-up on that is could you give an example of some of the projects, if we were to look on GitHub or other code repositories that really sort of demonstrate some of the things that you feel that really is what Bloomberg is all about, the ethos of Bloomberg in terms of giving back to the community?
Yeah, I mean, gosh, there's a number of them. We have done a number of contributions to things like solar search engines. There is a component, if you will, to solar, which was called learning to rank, something that was quite important to us. The ability to use sophisticated ranking algorithms in the search results. And that was adopted and that was used. That was, something that was, embraced by the community. And, when we did that, it was really about collaborating with a number of people. There was, it was about working with people from the open source community, from, other companies that, we wouldn't typically meet and work with. And, it was, I think, an example of what the open source community does best, bringing people together, working on these common problems, giving back and extending, its capabilities and all, for the good. There's tons of other examples. One is we are active supporters of the Jupyter Labs framework. A long time, a while ago, there was, this real evolution of Python notebooks to make it more open, support more languages, and really advance its capabilities. And the Jupyter Lab, the Jupyter Lab community grew. We have not only, contributed it. At one time, we had two of our staff members on the steering committee, but we also paid other organizations to work on Jupyter. We are using it as part of our products. We use it internally. And if this felt like the right thing to do for us in a number of dimensions. So Jupyter ecosystem is something that we do a lot with. Okay. So there's I can give you a lot more examples, but these are all, you know, we you know, some of it is on our public website, and we're pretty proud of these engagements.
Yes, it sounds really exciting. I mean, you know, the idea of open source goes hand in hand with cloud native computing and the things that you develop within the data center. I mean, would you be able to give me an idea of what are the main building blocks that you're using in terms of software? How do you construct the software side of your data center?
Yeah, that's a really complex question, and there's many parts. You know, I think when you look at what we, you know, what our modern tech stack looks like internally, it's embracing a lot of, you know, I think what most people would understand as kind of modern cloud, you know, software architecture, a container-based approach to software. We were early adopters in Kubernetes within our world, and also contribute to Kubernetes. Kubeflow, I think it was called, was something that we initiated and worked with Google and others. Kserve, I think, I'm sorry, that's the word, is Kserve. And so we are focusing a lot on automation throughout our data centers and throughout the ecosystem. So you would find it familiar. Most people would find it familiar, but we also have things that are really unique to us. Most of the open source world just doesn't deal with anything similar to market data. And so a big part of our systems and our unique part of our systems is really dealing with this massive flow of low latency, high volume data from exchanges and venues from around the world. And we source all of that flood of data. And, you know, just to give you a data point, I remember I was on a panel, this is years ago, I was on a panel with a discussion at Columbia University, and next to me was a gentleman from Twitter, and they were talking about, you know, being a real-time data system, large-scale, big data, and at the time he was mentioning about 500 million tweets a day. At Bloomberg, you know, we have, at this point, 300 billion messages or ticks a day, and they're actually about the same size in terms of bytes, typically structured data, but we have to ingest everyone, normalize them, process them, run analytics on them, build computation on them, and then distribute them to systems worldwide over one of the world's largest private global networks. And so when you think about that type of system, it's unique. Unique to us or a few people who kind of deal with this. And therefore, there are certain aspects of how we build our data centers, how we think about it, and how we build our global footprint that forces us to do things differently in our own way.
I mean, it's interesting you mentioned, I mean, is this data real time? I mean, I guess a lot of it is real time.
Absolutely.
And I'm just recalling back to our last conversation, and also what you were talking about earlier about your degree. Is hardware at the level where you have to do it yourself? Is that something that's become more prevalent? I mean, I've seen it in the industry where, you know, you have application-specific integrated circuits and things like that, FPGAs, being used to accelerate algorithms.
Yeah, you know, we are my team in the CTO office is constantly researching kind of the best mix. You'll find FPGAs and ASICs more prominent in the high frequency trading shops, And, you know, I talked to, you know, I just had talked to a customer of ours who also does high frequency trading. And we were having fun talking about kind of latest advancements and what they do there. But for the most part, we, for our market data distribution, we tended not to, even though we discuss this all the time, we typically don't use FPGAs or ASICs. There's always that trade-off that we do there. We are dealing with distributing market data in the milliseconds to our customers, and whereas in high-frequency trading, you're doing things in the nanoseconds. Our problem is slightly different, which is this huge volume of data through, you know, and allowing, you know, hundreds of thousands of customers and large systems subscribe to, you know, filter through all that data and get it to them as quickly as possible. Yeah. And so there is low latency, not the ultra low latency. But we do some of our own hardware. My team builds and has hardware engineers, electrical engineers, and mechanical engineers, and we build our own keyboards, Bloomberg keyboards. And the reason why that's important is because we have our own authentication device, fingerprint sensors, that we have built for years, where Bloomberg was one of the first to incorporate biometric authentication into our system as the default mechanism. And we've progressed and done that through the years. And so we build things like B units and keyboards. And so there you'll find, you know, some really interesting hardware. But for the most part, most of our data center is using really, you know, I would say, you know, interesting, but, you know, not specific hardware for Bloomberg.
Okay. I'm just going down the list of questions, and I understand, you know, you were talking about, you know, the issue for you is this, I guess it's having a large number of users and having this low latency, being able to distribute information to lots of people simultaneously. What would you say is the data challenge at Bloomberg? What's the thing that, well, keeps your team up at night?
Yeah. Well, besides the low latency, there's all sorts of other requirements, stability, uptime. These are massively important. So when we think about our architecture, I just happen to point out the latency requirements from the open source world. But a lot of what we do is thinking about that stability and, this uptime and consistent, service level that we offer our clients. Immensely important, so it does permeate through our kind of architectures and our systems.
Yes.
Data, you know, data is the lifeblood of you know what we do, is the lifeblood of Bloomberg, and it's such a broad discussion. There's so many topics that we can talk about, everything from sourcing large amounts of data from various. From various sources, and everything from, you know, data feeds and web scraping to analyzing this heterogeneous collection of large, messy data and making sense of it and digitizing it and giving it to our customers in a consumable fashion that makes sense, putting it and built in, allowing customers to run analytics on top of that. And so that, you know, we have a division and department at Bloomberg called Global Data, and we work closely with them. That's their job, to source this really interesting collection of data sets. So, you know, when you look at other kind of big data companies, you know, we won't have as much actual data stored in our hard drives as, you know, Google or because, you know, they do a lot with video, they do a lot with pictures, and they're doing a lot of stuff. Instead, Bloomberg has really this really interesting heterogeneous collection of structured and unstructured data, mixed from various sources. So from everything from, you know, pricing that's coming up that we already mentioned, to information about mortgage loans, to you know, looking at NOAA weather, you know, predictions and information, to geospatial information about factory locations, to look at economic forecasts and that's what really makes us really special, is the ability to take this data and to link it together. And that's the challenge. Anybody can, you know, pretty much nowadays, anybody can just collect data and put it on some databases and have it available. But that doesn't mean it's useful. And to model all this data, to tie it together, to be able to have the ability to translate or transverse all this data, to that enables you to build very powerful analytics that allow customers to ask the pertinent questions. And that's the hard part. Yeah. In order to do that, you do need people with really excellent, you know, technology. We need to have the technologists. We need to have the big data capabilities and techniques, but that's not enough. You need to have the domain experts that really understand all about that mortgage loan documents that are coming in, to really understand about that supply chain information, really understand the company fundamentals. That is, I think, the secret weapon that we have. And it's not so secret, right? We have built an amazing amount of really deep domain expertise in all of these. And when you layer it on with technology, that is the secret sauce.
Yes. And I'm just thinking about what you've just been talking about in terms of all the data and all the different data sources. I mean, would you say that today, post-COVID, the world is a kind of more unpredictable place? I mean, certainly in terms of stability, one could argue it's less stable, but just more unpredictable. But because, I mean, that has implications on how long data models last and how quickly they need to be changed and how things are adapting almost every day, every minute of every day, along with the real-time feeds that you have.
Yeah, you know, I think that I don't know how much COVID had changed. It obviously has affected the markets and affected how companies work. But there has been an increasing rate of change that we all, you know, acknowledge and see for years. And it's only, you know, it's only accelerating. Mm-hmm. And so the way to approach these problems is to really have flexibility with and how you structure your data, how you analyze it, and the systems behind, those modeling systems behind it. So it is a dynamic world, and you now need to use different tools. There's different data available. You know, one of the areas I'm focusing a lot on is bringing alternative data sources that, you know, we didn't address before, bringing them into the mix and building analytics on them and allowing our customers to really derive really powerful insights and use it for predictive analytics. Mm. When you look back some years ago, you know, some of these data sets were there, but we didn't have the machine learning capabilities and we didn't have the compute power to manage all that, to process it. Now we do. And we built up a, you know, real deep expertise in these areas, coupled with the domain expertise. Now we can actually bring some of these newer data sources, you know, these non-traditional data sources to bear. You deal with them differently. You really are taking more of a data science approach to it, more statistical approach to it. But some of them can be extremely powerful. And you're going to see, you know, soon some really interesting capabilities that we're bringing to market around this, which flows nicely into the workflows that our existing users are using. And that's, I think, the difference. So a lot of this alternative data sources were only available to some of the most sophisticated firms that really built up this capability, but we can take this capability and bring it to the masses. Mm. And so it shouldn't really matter that it's an alternative data source. Let's just take the alt out of alternative data.
Yes.
And just say this is just really rich data sources that have a lot of predictive signal in them.
Okay. I mean, I imagine that the software team, the programming teams at Bloomberg are not all in New York or London. It's quite a distributed workforce. Is that fair to say?
Actually, they are mainly in New York and London. Our the core of our engineers are the largest set is in New York, and we have a significant size of them in London. We do have teams. We have a San Francisco office that I work very closely with. It's a small, you know, relative small office, a couple hundred people. And we do have teams, various teams around the world, Frankfurt being one and Tokyo, et cetera. But Bloomberg is kind of a big believer. This is Mike Bloomberg's kind of, you know, vision from when he created the company a long time ago, is that people really need to work together. They need to be on the whiteboard. They need to create this kind of environment for innovation. And that innovation really requires these cross-discipline teams getting together and working together in this really dynamic environment. So that's, you know, yeah, we do have over 7,000 engineers, largely New York and London, and we do have some of them dispersed. But we very much are still in a company that when you're working on a problem, you build these small teams across groups, designers, product managers, even sometimes salespeople working together on the whiteboard, thinking about product design. And we're kind of big believers in that approach.
Mm. Does that work in a hybrid environment, or do people have to actually come into the London office and the New York office,
you know,
to achieve that sort of productivity and that collaboration?
You know, these are all the things we're all trying to figure out. I think the team did an amazing job during the pandemic. Everybody just, you know, just so proud of what our engineers did during the pandemic when we're all, you know, remote. And what we're trying to do is find that balance of, you know, working together physically. How do you achieve the same or similar capabilities while you're remote? And, you know, I think we're like other companies, you know, figuring out what works and what doesn't work. And sometimes it's different for different teams. And so, you know, that's kind of been a, you know, an interesting evolution. Yes. And I have to say that we're still working on it.
I have to bring this up, and just going back full circle to the beginning of the conversation. I mean, one of the things that you mentioned the last time we met in 2018 was quantum computing. And this ties back to, you know, the Cosmos book as well. And it's still, to me, I write a little bit about quantum computing. It still seems like rocket science, you know. And yeah. I was wondering, you know, 4 years on since we last met, are we closer? Closer to the reality, right? You know, there's a lot of benefits that people talk about, and, you know, there's some proof of concept type things. But, you know, is it something to start really looking into in a big way? As if it's going to be a revolution in a few years' time, so you really must start looking at it now.
No, I don't think so. I don't think we're at that point where, you know, it's a few years from now. You know, it's kind of proverbially, you know, more than that, proverbially 10 years away, whatever it is. Has progress been made? Sure. There's a lot of, you know, progress been made on the underlying science. There's understanding the capabilities, and people are doing, you know, a lot more interesting prototypes. I think we're still a ways off for a company like Bloomberg to really invest in that. And, you know, part of my job and part of my team's job, you know, is to have one, you know, to focus on emergent trends and lead the research arm of Bloomberg. And that's typically working on nearer term, you know, capabilities or existing capabilities out there. We work with academia. We work with the open source community. We build proof of concepts in the lab, working with our engineering partners to really explore capabilities, and we bring them in. That is one of the hats that we wear. The other hat is being product owners for core infrastructure and now recently actually customer-facing products that we have spearheaded. That research element is really important for us. And so keeping abreast of these things is important. It turns out that some of the more useful things that come out of quantum computing is more along the lines of quantum computing inspired algorithms. And so our quant teams have been looking at, you know, wow, there's been some achievements in improving certain algorithmic solutions because of the thinking around quantum computing. And so there's an interest and there's something useful yes. there. Even though I don't think we're there, you know, we're not diverting a lot of energy into getting ready for quantum computing. I think that would be a mistake on my part. There's so many other things that we can focus on.
Well, thank you very much, Sean. It's been lovely talking to you and to reacquaint with you after 4 years. Thank you very much.
Cliff, thank you.
You've been listening to Cliff Sarard and Sean Edwards. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.